Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a look into the post-9/11 intelligence industrial complex following the latest leaks from an employee of an intelligence contractor, Booz Allen Hamilton, who are in turn owned by the Carlyle Group. A former CIA veteran, Robert Baer, joins us to discuss the real story that has been lost amid the familiar civil liberties versus national security arguments, and that is that the taxpayer is being swindled by multi-billion dollar boondoggles that don't work. Then we'll look further into the post-9/11 national security swindles that promise Americans protection from terrorists but amount to nothing more than the greatest transfer of wealth from the public coffers to private hands in the history of the Republic, if not the world. Christopher Pyle, who teaches constitutional law and civil liberties at Mount Holyoke College and is the author of Military Surveillance and Civilian Politics, joins us to discuss what oversight exists over secret programs in the government-to-industry revolving door of government officials and contractors. Then finally, we will assess the latest report on global warming from the International Energy Agency that warns that the world's average temperature will increase by as much as 9.54 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. Cleo Pascal, a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs at Chatham House, London, and author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map, joins us to discuss what President Obama and China's President Xi agreed to do to address this crisis. And joining us now is Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
It's great to be back.
And the story that's going on now with this Snowden, Edward J. Snowden, and Booz Allen, and the NSA leak, etc., which is consuming the press, but it seems to me it's basically the old familiar argument of civil liberties versus national security. And what most of the press are missing, I think, is the real story here, which is this enormous boondoggle that's going on with Booz Allen, for whom this young man, Edward Snowden, worked, and the extent to which they are a classic revolving door. And they, in turn, Booz Allen, are owned by the Carlyle Group, which is another classic revolving door. When you look at the fact that Booz Allen's revenues for the last fiscal year was $5.76 billion, and they're number 436 on the Fortune 500 list of largest public companies, 98% of their revenues come from you and me and the taxpayer. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, Ian, first of all, I take issue with your word choice. It's not a revolving door. It's a swindle. I had a young man working for me. He was what's called a reports officer. He simply edited reports from the field. And one day he comes to me and says, you know, I got a great offer with Booz Allen. He resigned from the CIA the next day with his top secret security clearance, which is in itself has a value, went to work for Booz Allen. He was promised training. He was promised, a way up the corporate ladder and so forth and so forth. He came back, worked for me again in exactly the same job with no training, with a little bit more salary, and Booz Allen made five times what he was making on his contract. It is just a great swindle. There is no other way to put it. When you consider this young man didn't have a high school education, didn't complete high school, goes to work for the federal government at $200,000 a year, you can count on Booz Allen making off that contract $1 million. Maybe more. I don't know. It's hard to tell. You lose sight of this. This whole contracting thing has taken billions upon billions of dollars, you know, hived it off the federal budget, goes where we don't know. There's absolutely no internal controls. And it's just a great swindle for no value added.
Well, it's a perfect swindle in the sense that the people who are swindling the government are working for a secret government agency, the National Security Agency, and right across the street you have Booz Allen. and the NSA basically gives them the blank check, and they provide services which apparently the Congress is not exercising any kind of oversight over what they're buying. My understanding is this project that Snowden leaked, PRISM, is a vast boondoggle. It doesn't do a damn thing in terms of the war on terror.
Look, Ian, there is no one has come forward and showed how PRISM saved American lives. I've seen allusions to the subway bomber, Zazi, and the rest of it. But if you look at the court documents, they all point toward British sources tracking a bomb maker. And right across the board, look, the point is that with PRISM and getting in the metadata, the telephone companies, this stuff is extremely useful after an event occurs, not before. The software does not work. You can't put in like a Google-like search saying, you know, where are the terrorists in the world, and it comes up with an answer. It doesn't work that way. I worked for the Special Tribunal for Lebanon. I watched how, after the assassination of the prime minister, they got into the data, the metadata, and figured out who the assassins were. But again, it was after the event, not before. And what we're doing is taking all this money and pretending that we can stop terrorism by, you know, a magic bullet. There is no magic bullet in this. It doesn't work. There is no algorithm that can predict the future and predict what people are going to do. It just, I can't talk about the future, but it doesn't work now, and it doesn't justify the billions upon billions of dollars. And we are being swindled, every penny of this. And you know, I stay on the phone all day with people in the intelligence agencies, people just retired, and the rest of it. I'm on the phone with the SEALs. All the rest of them call it a swindle. These are active operators on the ground that do the hard work, that stop the terrorism, that went after bin Laden, and they call it a swindle. And they resent the contractors, and they resent people in Congress making money off of this. And like this young man, whether it doesn't matter whether he's right or wrong about the civil liberties, the point is, what was he doing in that job without a high school degree? It's nuts.
And you're saying that his salary was $200,000, but Booz Allen, because they sold his contract, they're making about $1 million out of him?
Absolutely. What happens is you go into the CIA, you get the CIA to pay for a security clearance, which costs a lot of money to do a background investigation, polygraphs. Once you have that top secret security clearance, then you go farm yourself out to one of these contractors like Booz Allen, who doesn't do anything to vet these people. All they care about is they have a top secret security clearance, hire them, you know, boost their salary to whatever. Well, in this case, it was a lot. This guy probably came in at $30,000 or $40,000. So they treble his salary at the very least, or quadruple it. But on top of that, they quadruple the fee, pretending they're doing something.
That's their value added, in other words. In other words, their value added to the U.S. government.
Their value added, their cost added.
Sure.
Five times the contract.
Wow.
It can be less, can be more. I just don't know. You can't say. There's not a general rule.
But what you're telling us here, Robert Baer, is that not only are they the basis of the contracts, all of this, these so-called technical fixes to terrorism, these technological fixes involving software programs and algorithms, that's what they sell in terms of hardware, which doesn't work. But in terms of software, in terms of brain power, they're also poaching from the government. So they get it both ways. They make money out of people they poach out of the government, and they make enormous amounts of money out of the government selling stuff that we don't know what it is and whether it works. And when you've got people like John McConnell, who now works for Booz Allen, the former head of the NSA, obviously signing off on all of these deals, and then James Clapper, the current director of National Intelligence, who's a former Booz Allen director, there you have the revolving door, and the company itself is owned by the ultimate revolving door, which is the Carlyle Group, started by Frank Carlucci, President Reagan's national security advisor.
Ian, it's called feather bedding. It's been around since the beginning of man. The generals keep their mouths shut, keep these programs going, go to Congress, say they need them. They get their 4-star, and when they retire, they get a job. They get paid off. And they go back, and they run these companies. They sit on the boards. They don't do anything. And the carousel just continues. And, you know, you look back at Boston, where, you know, if any time the algorithm should have been kicked in is then. But they weren't, because it doesn't work. I mean, this guy's travel to Dagestan should have gone in the system, and it should have kicked in Prism or, you know, whatever else these programs are. And they should have said, hey, this guy's got, you know, there's red lights flashing everywhere. But since the system doesn't work, it didn't work in the case of Boston.
So this is a big emperor's clothes con, that you've got the president pretending that this is a front line in our national security, that the NSA have their finger in the dam, keeping the hordes at bay. Feinstein on the Intelligence Committee, she goes along with it. Everybody's going along with it. As I say, all they're talking about now are the old familiar arguments of civil liberties versus national security, but nobody's talking about the real issue here, which is how much the taxpayer is being ripped off in the name of national security. And I guess my question to you, Robert Baer, is if we have, as you said, this feather bedding's been going on forever, why don't they at least do something useful with all the money that they steal? I mean, why don't they make something that works?
Because you can't make any money off hiring civil servants that know what they're doing. There's no money to be made off that. There's, you know, you've got federal employees, go out and find new people, hire them, they indoctrinate them in the system, they train them, they have a 30-year career. You don't make any money off that. You need this churn of software, churn of new equipment, churn of contracts. That is where the big skimming is done. I mean, with the civil service, there's no money to be made. It comes in contracts, and especially when it's secret, because no one can evaluate it on the outside. You say, well, where's the president in this? The president, this is the security industrial complex. If he took it on, that whole thing would come after him. I don't know what he thinks about all this, but it would come after him. There'd be generals popping up on Fox News. There'd be people popping up on CNN and the rest of it saying the president is undermining our security. And he's sitting on a tiger he can't get off of. And he knows it, because they'll start leaking on him. So he just, you know, what can you do? I mean, it's Congress, but to get elected to Congress, it costs, this is a couple of years, it costs $6 million a seat. And each time you get elected, every 2 years, you've got to raise that money from venture capitalists, from the Carlyle Group, from bundling, from law firms, and the rest of it. And it's a, you know, Congress is venture capital itself. It's a way to go make money in Washington. And Ian, I am here to tell you that since 9/11, there's been the biggest transfer of wealth in American history from public hands to private, thanks to this security nonsense.
So again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon, and he's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers. So I'm just trying to get my head around the scope of this scandal, because the only people who ostensibly have oversight over this racket, because of the revolving door and because it's so entrenched at the highest level with people, you know, like the Carlyle Group owning Booz Allen, et cetera, and everything is so classified, nobody knows what the government's buying, and it doesn't matter if it doesn't work because they tell us it works, even if it doesn't, and they lie, as you pointed out, about Zazi being the only example they've come up with so far, and he was being run by the Brits at any rate. So what about the oversight people? I mean, if we're relying on the Congress, and after all, Michelle Bachmann was on the Intelligence Committee, so that doesn't give us much to hope for there. They're a part of the same food chain, aren't they? Because
the one time there was a whistleblower inside the NSA was a guy named Drake.
Right. I talked to him the other day, yeah.
Yeah, and the person at the Senate, a woman, as a result of this, got her house raided by the FBI with guns drawn. She'd retired, and they accused her of leaking warrantless wiretaps. Same way with Drake, guns drawn, come through the door. You know, if you're in the House and you're a lone staffer and you take this system on, someone's going to accuse you of leaking secrets or compromising American security, and they will come through your doors. This is just a fact. I mean, right. You know, whether Drake's right or wrong, I don't know, or the Senate staffer, that's what happened.
Well, Drake got off. They had to drop the case because it was...
Yeah, but his life is ruined.
Oh, I know. And Bradley Manning will...
He was talking about this carousel of stealing money. And that's what happened to him.
And Bradley Manning will spend the rest of his life in jail. And this guy, Snowden, will probably spend the rest of his life in jail, assuming that he's not escaped the clutches of either the Chinese or the CIA in Hong Kong. But again, I just wanted to get a sense, is it this completely corrupt that the only people that we rely on to have oversight over this scandalous, enormous transfer of wealth, this raid on the Treasury that's happened since 9/11, are the Congress, and they rely on the same food chain, do they not, in terms of campaign finance? I would hazard a guess that both the Carlyle Group and Booz Allen give a lot of money out, right, to congressmen and senators.
It's all bundled. You know, we don't know where it goes. A lawyer's a big law firm in D.C. sit down. They're instructed, all right, everybody give $10,000 to this one congressman for this election. This person's key. It's an old story. That's not my specialty. It's an old story. But, yeah, you cannot talk about this. I mean, you cannot. You know, people were telling me that we're building this stuff, that iris recognition from 35 feet is great. You know, you can take a photograph and tell somebody's identity from taking a picture of their eye. Well, you know, they tried that on Tamerlan, Boston Bomber. It didn't work. And we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars was put into a program that didn't work.
And this goes on all the time.
Ian, you got to understand that I worked on a terrorism investigation where we used the same data after the event. This is very important, and it worked brilliantly, but it was all done with a FISA warrant, the equivalent of a FISA warrant in Lebanon, where you went in and you made the telephone companies give up their metadata. But it was targeting specific phones, not everybody in the country, and we already knew what had happened, of course.
Right.
But you don't need to take this software and try to read all communications in this country and the rest of the world. You know, it is an enormous price, and pretend it works. After 9/11, you figure out who did it. You ask for a FISA warrant for the 19 hijackers. All of these companies are more than happy to oblige. Doesn't matter. Cell phone companies, it's all done. But we're just adding this fake science in order to transfer wealth.
But I think it's also a part, is it not, of this belief that there is a technical fix to national security. It's like what the Star Wars was in the nuclear competition with the Russians. It was a technological fantasy that was going to suddenly change this impossibly dangerous nuclear arms race. And, of course, they're still wasting money on Star Wars as we speak. And it seems to be the same thing, that this is the promise that there's a technical fix to what ultimately can only be solved through human intelligence. And my sense is that the CIA, if they hired this high school dropout, he doesn't even have a high school diploma, and then he ends up working for tripling or quadrupling his salary at Booz Allen after serving as a IT analyst, I believe, at the CIA. What's happened to the CIA? I mean, I thought they used to recruit the smartest people.
No, they don't. It's dead. It's all contractors. The whole place is run by contractors. People just scream and yell about it. Contractors are running overseas CIA station and bases. They actually, contractors are doing it, not federal employees. They're sent out to these places. All right, you run this place for 6 months. Same way with Iraq was run by contractors. So was Afghanistan. And it's just a flow of these people. And there are contractors hiring contractors. And there's no control over it. And what they do is the CIA is putting all of its money. You look at the case in Moscow where they had this recruitment letter. I mean, this stuff is called virtual recruitment. It's done off the Internet. Somebody had the bright idea is that you control the Internet to find human sources. And the Russians showed us what happens with that when they got that guy arrested. So, no, it's...
Well, he was an embarrassment, though, wasn't he? I mean, that reinforces my argument.
He was a real person, but he got caught up in this trying to recruit people by over the Internet.
Right, but his tradecraft was terrible, though. I mean, what I'm saying...
Well, they don't do tradecraft. No one knows what tradecraft is. They don't know how to work in Moscow. You can run circles around the Russians if you want. If you've been doing it for years and gone through the training, but that guy clearly didn't. I mean, they've got ways to actually disguise it. You can't tell who people are. They're not cheap blonde wigs.
Right.
But people don't know how to do that anymore.
Well, that's the point, I think. It looks like all this money that's flowed in since 9/11 has completely corrupted our intelligence and devalued the professionalism, and it's just become a big boondoggle for all of these pigs with their snouts in the trough.
It's Nigeria on the Potomac.
Oh, my God. So it's that bad, right? All right. Well, I must say, I was looking for somebody to talk to because I felt that this was where the story really lies, and you've given me a hell of a lot more than I expected. So I'm going to have to scratch my head for a while and digest it all.
Ian, I'm just channeling what people tell me. I've been out of the CIA for a long time, and the people come out the door, they one way or another call me up, and all have similar complaints at whatever grade they retired at or left or unhappy or happy. They all say the same thing. It's not... No one comes out and says, look, if you only knew what was going on, you'd keep your mouth shut. And no one says that.
Everyone basically says that the taxpayer is getting screwed and that this contractor...
Everyone. And this is Special Forces as well, too.
Right.
I just had a long conversation with them. And they feel the same way.
Right. So what we thought about in terms of what Halliburton was to the Department of Defense, the Booz Allen people are to, and there's others as well, Lockheed Martin, for example, are to in intelligence. So you have a military-industrial complex, you have a terrorism-industrial complex, and you also have an intelligence-industrial complex, all stealing money at the same time.
Look, if you want to make money, don't go to Wall Street, go to Washington. Get a contract.
Well, Robert Baer, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back looking further into the post-9/11 national security swindles.
Revolving doors, what have I done? For someone on the TV, a tepid Lowe's. Revolving doors, what will I become? In the redneck sun, he paid up for a seven.
Put it on. And where's all the money gone? Where's all the money gone? Or have I got things added up all wrong? Did she break the little nest egg that I was sitting on? Where's all the money gone? Where's all the money gone?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christopher Pyle, who teaches constitutional law and civil liberties at Mount Holyoke College and is the author of Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics and Getting Away with Torture. In 1970, he disclosed the U.S. military's surveillance of civilian politics and worked as a consultant to three congressional committees, including the Church Committee. His articles on military surveillance of civilian politics won the Polk and Hillman Awards for Investigative Journalism, and he is currently a member of the board of directors of the ACLU of Massachusetts, and he has an article at counterpunch.org, Edward Snowden, Profile in Courage. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Pyle.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Christopher, I must say that Robert Baer sort of pushed a few more scales off my eyes, not that I have too many left, I think. Talking about Congress is itself a venture capital organization, and Washington is Nigeria on the Potomac. I mean, it seems to me that he's right on in terms of looking into this aspect of this story about the CIA, this NSA contractor who's holed up somewhere in Hong Kong, that it's really, again, as the old Watergate adage was, follow the money.
Yes, isn't it remarkable? I used to spend all my time working on civil liberties questions, including civil liberties in the intelligence community. But my current book that I'm writing is on campaign finance reform, because money now rules Congress, and it rules the federal budget. 70% of the intelligence budget now goes to private corporations. Members of Congress don't spend their time overseeing the intelligence agencies. Instead, they spend their time soliciting contracts for their constituent corporations from the intelligence agencies. And this is a radical change. It's where the money's at. Bob Baer is right. And if we are going to have a constitution, what we really need is not to go to Washington and lobby on ideas of liberty and equality and justice. We got to go and buy back the Constitution. We got to give money to politicians on the intelligence committees and elsewhere to get back our Constitution. Everything has become commodified. Our Constitution is a commodity. Civil libertarians are just another interest group in the eyes of the politicians to be mollified if they can help the politicians get reelected.
So, Christopher Pyle, there, it's too idealistic to think that you can come up with a regime of taking the money out of politics and putting the voters back in, because, as you know, we have some of the worst statistics in terms of who the numbers that vote in elections. Here in Los Angeles, we just elected a new mayor who was identical to the other one that ran, the other candidate who ran. They both wasted tons of money on two campaigns, a runoff and a general campaign. And we're getting to the point where you're going to need $1 million to run for dog catcher in our politics. It's not to mention that the last election cycle, according to investigative journalist John Nichols and Bob McChesney in their latest book, Dollarocracy, the last campaign cost $10 billion.
And the next one will cost more. And there are actually two powerful forces of corruption involved in this story. The first is money in politics. The second is the bloated secrecy system. Everything is classified secret these days, and it doesn't need to be. Bradley Manning disclosed, 500,000 documents that were classified secret or confidential, with no discernible harm to the republic, because anything classified at that level is innocuous. Only a few things classified top secret might be real secrets. Most real secrets are classified well above top secret.
Well, this guy, actually, Snowden, released stuff that was special compartmentalized information, which is pretty much above the top. I mean, it's literally a finding from the President of the United States about who we're going to target for cyber warfare, which wasn't obviously very welcome on the eve of him lecturing the Chinese leader about.
Yes, quite embarrassing. Yes. Well, those are – some of those may be important secrets that are worth protecting. I hadn't heard that he had disclosed targets. I didn't think that was his shtick. He disclosed a court order, which raises an interesting question. Why should a court order be classified? Why should we have secret courts? Aren't secret courts an oxymoron? Aren't they a very contradiction of everything the justice system stands for?
Well, there's so many things that we accept that, you know, at the risk of sounding like Ron Paul, I mean, that violate the Constitution. I mean, the Fourth Amendment is all but shredded. For example, I think it's Article 1 of the Constitution that says that the government shall publish all revenues and expenses in a budget in a public way. I can't remember the exact text of the Constitution, But it's very clear that it says that the government has to publish a public budget. Well, we have black budgets, you know. The IRS, right. the IRS can invade your person and papers under the Fourth Amendment. There's been incremental bites at the Constitution, but the secrecy culture really operates in this multi-billion-dollar way. That's, I think, quite new. I mean, this contractor phenomenon, it was bad enough that the old military-industrial complex had a snout in the trough and was raiding the treasury since Eisenhower coined the phrase. But now you have this extra layer of avarice and theft.
Yes, and that began about 1980. After the church committee on which I worked finished its job, we created these permanent intelligence committees and couldn't get people of any great distinction to serve on them because there was no money to be made on them. Members of Congress joined committees in proportion to the capacity of those committees to help them raise money. But then, in the 80s, as the counterterrorism business got going, as Iran-Contra got going and such, people began to realize that there's money to be made in this game. And then they began to get more active members. And today, now, people want to be on the intelligence committees because there's so much money to be raised doing it. And these are the same people who will now denounce Edward Snowden as a traitor and so forth, giving up the crown jewels. But Snowden wouldn't have done what he did if it wasn't for the fact that he knew he could not go to the intelligence committees with his story and get any action. And he couldn't go to the inspector generals in the Defense Department or NSA and get any satisfaction because he saw what happened to Thomas Drake when Thomas Drake went after a similar case of fraud and abuse involving data mining. And so he went to became a whistleblower. He committed an act of civil disobedience and became a whistleblower. And he'll probably suffer for it grievously because the government's going to come down on him and claim that he gave away the crown jewels.
Well, clearly that's what they're doing.
Maybe he didn't. We'll wait and see on that.
I'm speaking to Christopher Pyle, who teaches constitutional law and civil liberties at Mount Holyoke College and is the author of Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics and Getting Away with Torture. In 1970, he disclosed the U.S. military surveillance of civilian politics and worked as a consultant to three congressional committees, including the Church Committee. His articles on military surveillance of civilian politics won the Polk and Hillman Awards for Investigative Journalism, and he's currently a member of the Board of Directors of the ACLU of Massachusetts, and he has an article at counterpunch.org, Edward Snowden, Profile in Courage. Now, after this church committee that you worked on, Christopher, and the regime got underway, a lot of people in the CIA and other agencies, but mostly the CIA, used to refer to the Intelligence Commission, the House and Senate Select Intelligence Commission. They used to refer to them as the mushroom farm, that we keep them in the dark and every now and then we throw manure on them. Lately you've got people like Michelle Bachmann on the intelligence committees and some of the earlier guys like Pat Roberts were just pathetic. I mean, embarrassing. So has it served the interest of the secrecy community to have these clearly inadequate, shall we say, to be polite, people like Michelle Bachmann on the committee and Pat Roberts and I don't think
Mike
Rogers.
Well, that's exactly what any bureaucracy wants. Uh-huh. It wants to have the weakest oversight committee possible. Between having an oversight committee and not having one, it's always better to have one that is weak because then you can say, as the president claimed, that, oh, yes, we have complete legislative oversight. Everybody has been properly briefed. It's baloney, of course. But to the inattentive public, it works. And so let's say that there is a firestorm of protest from these disclosures. What will happen? Dianne Feinstein and the Senate Intelligence Committee will hold hearings, and nothing will happen.
Well, already Feinstein and the Republican minority chair, Saxby Chambliss, have come out with all kinds of huffing and puffing about how terrible the AP leaks were and how terrible the how much they affected national security. And as Bob Baer pointed out, by the way, and they've done the same with Snowden, Bob Baer pointed out that the only thing that they're arguing about what was compromised in terms of this release revolves around this guy's Zazi Najibullah, who was supposed to be the backpack bomber. And I've noticed that he's been Trump put out there as an example of how the metadata intercepted an email that he sent to his handler in Pakistan, asking him how to mix the chemicals to make this PTN explosive, and he included his phone number in Denver, Colorado. I mean, with terrorists like that, you know, who needs interdiction if that's the case? But anyway, it turns out that from what Bob was saying from the court documents, that the Brits were onto this case anyway. It had nothing. It wasn't an example as they put out as how wonderful PRISM works.
Well, it's easy to find the needle in the haystack if you know what the needle is and you know its magnetic resonance. That's not hard. And that's the way most investigations go. But this system, run by people like Booz Allen and others, thinks that you find needles in the haystack by adding more hay. They believe that we need much, much more hay. It's all a waste of money. A focused investigation works much better. We now have over 70 fusion centers at the state level. Are you acquainted with those?
No, tell me about them.
These are state police or municipal police intelligence units that exist to collect suspicious incident reports of things happening in local communities. And they think that if they massage enough of that data, they'll find patterns and practices. Excuse me. Among groups like the Quakers, and will therefore be able to predict future attacks on the Defense Department. It's all nonsense. That's what the Army did when I disclosed its operations. It's what it did with the Counterintelligence Field Activity Unit in 2005, which I helped to disclose, which is now out of business. It's the great Hoover vacuum cleaner upgraded for the digital age. It promises, by the mystique of algorithms, to actually find actionable intelligence. It does nothing of the sort, as Bob Baer pointed out. I'm a former intelligence officer. He's one of vast more experience than I had, but we both know that the way you conduct an investigation is to start with some leads. Start with something substantial. Then maybe you need to track cell phones. Maybe you need to track stuff like that. But what you don't need to do, what they're doing, is recording everybody's cell phone data for 5-10 years, putting in the big warehouse, and then searching it later.
Well, because the big warehouse, which is the $5 billion thing that they're building up in outside of Salt Lake City in Utah,
is going to
employ a lot of Republicans. You know, this is really, I'm afraid, this is right-wing welfare, you know. This is socialism. I mean, like, how can all these patriots puff their chests and talk about welfare queens and Obamacare and all of this stuff that they rail against when they're all sucking off this big, giant, I can't use the word on the radio.
That's true. But any political persuasion can make money off this. That's what corporations exist to do, is to make money.
Right. Well,
but as Bob said, the way to make money today, and has been for the last 30 years, is to go to Washington with an army full of lobbyists.
Well, Christopher Pyle, let's stay in touch. When your book is done, I'd love to talk to you about it.
I'll be glad to talk with you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Christopher Pyle, who teaches constitutional law and civil liberties at Mount Holyoke College and is the author of Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics and Getting Away with Torture. In 1970, he disclosed the U.S. military surveillance of civilian politics and worked as a consultant to three congressional committees, including the Church Committee. His articles on military surveillance of civilian politics won the Polk and Hillman Awards for Investigative Journalism, and Christopher Pyle is currently a member of the Board of Directors of the ACLU of Massachusetts, and he has an article at counterpunch.org, Edward Snowden, Profile in Courage. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and assess the latest report on global warming from the International Energy Agency. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Cleo Pascal, who specializes in geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And she was one of three recipients of the 2010 Award of Special Merit for the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure. Good to hear from you. Thanks.
And Cleo, the International Energy Agency just released a report warning that the world's average temperature will increase by as much as 9.54 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. We don't know what went on with the two presidents meeting out here in Palm Springs, President Obama and the Chinese leader, President Xi, but they said that they were going to deal with global warming and other gases, the ones that use in refrigerators, for example. But this report and what little we know about the agreement there seems to be a large gap between them, shall we say.
Yeah, and it's unfortunately a bit of an indication of a failure of the Kyoto process, because both the report and what's come out of the Obama-Xi visit seems to be looking for solutions that have very little to do with kind of traditional pathways like carbon dioxide reduction. So what we see out of the Obama-Xi meeting is a potential commitment to reduce hydrofluorocarbons, which is what we started to use in exchange for the gases that we used to use that used to deplete the ozone layer. So we replaced one problem with another problem, and these HFCs, these hydrofluorocarbons, are, as it turns out, incredibly potent greenhouse gases. And so cutting that down is actually relatively easy, because when you cut down on the HFCs, you're creating a level economic playing field. Everybody is having to do the same thing. It's very easy to monitor. It's pretty straightforward. Whereas dealing with carbon dioxide emissions is much more complex, because it's implicit throughout the energy sector. So they're started sort of trying to chip away at the problems in bits and pieces, and we see the same thing coming out of the IEA report, where the sort of things that are being recommended are things like minimizing methane emissions from upstream oil and gas production, or energy efficiency, or dealing with coal power plants. It's kind of sort of saying an acknowledgement that, you know, what we've tried to do at the international level has failed, and so we're going to have to come at this problem in a whole bunch of different ways.
But the long and the short of it is they're not biting the big bullet, right? Is that they're sort of dancing around the periphery?
Well, for me, one of the biggest issues is that they're not dealing at all with adaptation issues. So as we saw with Sandy, you know, you can have 2 degrees or you can have 9 degrees, but if you're still building in floodplains or on invulnerable seaside areas, you're still going to have an impact. So yes, we need to deal obviously with the things that are creating or destabilizing the climate, but at the same time, we also need to start looking at, for example, how the National Flood Insurance Program works, how zoning regulations work, you know, how we continue to put critical pieces of infrastructure and lives in danger's way. You know, that situation is not getting better, not being addressed at all, and that's what's going to be hitting us hardest, fastest.
But that suggests, Cleo Pascal, that we have to accept the fact that global warming is going to change the planet, the ocean is going to rise, and that we have to essentially turn the planet into a version of Holland.
Well, it is. The climate is changing and the oceans are rising. And of more concern, you know, you're getting increasing storm surges and unpredictable weather, and that's happening. And it's being exacerbated by even more direct forms of changing the environment, like depletion of groundwater, building in floodplains, the destruction of coastal barrier islands, those sorts of things that have nothing to do with climate change, but which we're doing anyway for a range of other generally short-term economic reasons. So there's no question that that is happening and will continue to happen, and we need to address that as well as addressing the factors that are going to affect the climate. I'm personally extremely concerned because we're at a stage now where the climate feedback mechanisms are starting to come into play. So you're seeing CO2 saturation in the oceans. The oceans are one of the largest absorbers of CO2 on the planet. And as they absorb more and more CO2, their ability to absorb CO2 decreases. So you end up with ocean acidification and a reduction in the ocean's abilities to absorb CO2. That's happening already. So once those feedback mechanisms start to come into play, once the permafrost thaws and releases more methane, you start getting all these kicks and bumps and feedbacks into the system, and it becomes increasingly destabilized. So we are at that point now. And, it's great that any initiative that the IEA or that Obama and Xi are pushing forward, you know, great, everything is helpful. But we are in a situation now where we need to look at absolutely everything that has to do with physical infrastructure, because it's all unstable.
Again, I'm speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and she was one of 3 recipients of the 2010 Award of Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. So given that the IEA report notes that China experienced the largest growth in CO2 emissions, and clearly a lot of that's to do with the coal-fired plants, every time apparently people can't even breathe in Beijing for most of the year, but of course most of the CO2 that's up there now is what the U.S. and other industrial powers have put up over the last few decades. So just give us a sense then of what if we went cold turkey on CO2 and stopped it, we'd still have a problem, it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like the problem is far, far more dire than the political authorities, not to mention the business leaders, have grasped.
Yes, it is. And, I mean, for example, what happened with Sandy was predicted. the National Hurricane Center had, you know, a detailed prediction of what would happen in that sort of storm situation hitting the northeast coast of the U.S., and they have predicted that that sort of thing is likely to become more common. So, you know, it's not like the science isn't there and the science isn't being borne out. We know we have a problem, and we're seeing it happen as predicted. Now, the range, of course, may vary. It may be more or less severe, but the trend is towards increasing, you know, extreme events, and at the same time, we're creating more vulnerable infrastructure. So there's no question, you know, we have a problem. And some countries have, at least part of their policy circles, are positioning themselves, making that assumption. So China, for example, does have very serious domestic environmental problems, but they're incorporating environmental change into their foreign policy strategy by, for example, positioning itself very well in the Arctic. So, you know, China has an icebreaker. It's in the process of building a second icebreaker. It's, you know, it kind of becoming an observer at the Arctic Council. It's built the largest embassy in Iceland. It's heavily engaging in Greenland. You know, so it is possible to incorporate the changes into policy. However, it seems to be that the main motivator now seems to be largely, you know, economic or geostrategic, but we also at the same time need to incorporate it from a more defensive perspective so that we're not just trying to gain from it like China is doing in the Arctic, but we're also limiting loss and we don't end up with repeated strikes on, you know, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. We were very lucky with Sandy that none of those chemical factories along the New Jersey shore breached. That's an extremely likely scenario for that kind of activity. We need to take it seriously. It's happening now.
Well, Claire Pascal, here in the United States, it's just mind-boggling when you consider that there's still a constituency, in part funded by a couple of billionaires, the Koch brothers, to deny the very existence. So we're way behind even in terms of accepting the reality. And then on top of that, our political authorities are talking about very modest fixes at the periphery of this massive looming problem, and not really telling us anything about how serious it is, let alone how to make the radical steps necessary that would probably dwarf the race to the moon and the Manhattan Project. And then on top of that, what you're telling us is that now, beyond that, we should be thinking about what to do about the real effects of global warming, which is the oceans rising. It's already happening. And if we, if our consciousness hasn't caught up to us, the planet's going to catch up to us.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think that there's a real misunderstanding of this issue within the business community. So, you know, for example, the Koch brothers do a lot of infrastructure work, you know, pipelines and that sort of stuff. And their pipelines will be affected by environmental change. They think they think they're being clever by undermining, you know, the debate around the issue. But what they're going to find is they're going to start losing money very rapidly as this infrastructure that they're pushing through becomes undermined as, again, you know, if they're building pipelines in the north as the permafrost thaws or as rivers flood or, you know, there are no shortcuts. You cannot make money business as usual because the situation is not as usual. So if the business community, you know, sort of took a step back and actually looked at this, they'd realize that they need to address this for their own self-interest, for their own short-term and long-term self-interest. We did a study looking at how environmental change will affect energy infrastructure. For example, you know, the nuclear lobby in France has been pushing nuclear power as a solution to environmental change issues, which is a whole other debate. But what we found was that, you know, those nuclear facilities are actually functioning very poorly because they require a certain amount of cold water to cool their plants. Most of them are built on rivers. The rivers are running hotter and they're running lower because of climate change. And as a result, they can't cool their plants properly. So they've had emergency shutdowns, you know, in 2003, 2006, 2009, 2011, and every time they have to buy power from outside of France to supplement their deficiencies. So this is not abstract. This is it's happening now, and it's costing money. And if the business sector thinks that they're being clever by ignoring it, they're not. They're affecting their own bottom line.
Well, just to add to that, believe it or not, the only nuclear power plant that's been approved in the United States is one in Georgia that's on a river that depends upon water from a river that's drying up.
Well, exactly. And that's the sort of kind of short-term assessment that's undermining the stability of our economy. I mean, the West's economy is incredibly fragile now at this very moment. And there's no reason to be making these kinds of mistakes. The science is good enough now to know where the problem areas are going to be. You know, and you mentioned investment. You know, if the stimulus package funding had gone towards building defenses or a stable and secure infrastructure, we would be much, much better off than if it goes towards, you know, building bridges in the same locations where they were just washed out by a flood, for example. So, you know, we have the everything is in place to build a stable, secure infrastructure that can help us economically develop and create a more secure future, but we're not connecting those dots.
Well, as a result,
everybody's going to lose, from the Koch brothers to the farmers to, you know, everybody in Vegas who's depending on a water supply that's completely unsustainable.
But what about the stimulus going towards, you know, a battery, or get rid of gas in cars and trucks and transportation? And I mean, is there any way to get off the carbon fix that we're on?
Well, interestingly, one of the IEA report makes four recommendations, and one of their recommendations is accelerating the phase out of subsidies to fossil fuel consumption. And they make the, you know, rather interesting point that, you know, we're at a time when budgets are very tight, so why are we using our budgets to subsidize this sector? So, you know, there is a complete artificial economy built around the energy sector, right? So if you get rid of subsidies, you have, you know, renewables may become more competitive, efficiencies may make more sense, that sort of stuff. We have enormous amount of line loss, enormous amount of inefficiency. I'm here in the UK at the moment. UK government buildings produce more emissions than all of Kenya, largely because, you know, they're single-paned, rattly windows that are leaking heat, you know, at every single second when it gets cold. So, you know, there are enormous areas in the systems where efficiencies can be made, but there's no economic incentive now to be efficient. We have our economic structure set up to consume, not to be efficient. So, you know, you need to look, if you really want to find a lasting solution, you need to work with economic structures that can promote healthier behavior. For example, work with the insurance sector on making sure developments don't go up in dangerous areas. Mm-hmm. You know, work with energy pricing to incentivize efficiencies and the input of renewables into the grid. You know, incentivize the creation of critical infrastructure in areas that are not vulnerable to environmental change. Price water in such a way so that you're not depleting aquifers in insane ways.
Well, Cleo, I'm so grateful that you stayed up for us, and I appreciate it very much.
Always a pleasure. Okay. Thank you for bringing up the topic again.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and she was one of three recipients of the 2010 Award of Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.